It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, a group of former Oconto Falls Public School District students filed a federal civil rights lawsuit alleging that the district in northeastern Wisconsin failed to prevent sexual abuse by teachers and staff members.
The lawsuit alleges the Oconto Falls District fostered a climate that allowed students to be groomed and abused for over 15 years.
In a statement to WPR, the district's superintendent said the school cannot comment on this lawsuit, but remain confident that they will continue to act promptly to any allegations of misconduct.
At the state capitol this month, Democratic Governor Tony Evers signed a pair of bills into law, one that makes grooming a felony crime, another that requires school districts to adopt policies on appropriate communication between employees and students. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter covering K-12 education. Corey, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
This complaint spans years at the Oconto Falls School District. What's at the heart of it? What's being alleged?
No, there's a lot of things being alleged. And like you said, it spans 20 years and it includes grooming and sexual conduct by multiple staff members involving more than a dozen minor students at the high school.
And at the press event yesterday, it was three students who came forward. Is that right? Former students?
Yes, the complaint was filed by three women who are now adults, who they all graduated from Oconto Falls High School, and they say that they were sexually abused by school staff when they were teenagers. But their attorneys say that there are at least 14 other known victims who are willing to share their stories.
Why, Corey, is a suit being filed now if the alleged abuse went on for, 20 years?
Well, their attorney says that these women are coming forward now because they want to solve what they say is an institutional problem at both the high school and at the district. They say that there's a culture where sex abusers and groomers and other school staff believe that what's going on there is okay, and they don't believe that it will end unless they come forward.
Okay, so they're pointing two examples then of how this is an institutional problem in the school system, not just, one or two bad actors.
Right. I mean, the lawsuit, makes claims that were pretty disturbing. I mean, one of the women say that in an essay while she was in high school, she wrote about having this relationship with an adult male. And so other people read it, other adults read it and knew about it. Another one of the accusers say that other adults knew that she was sleeping in bed with an adult volleyball coach, and nobody did anything about it. They're just like example after example where adults could have stepped in and didn't.
Corey, does this federal civil rights lawsuit include information or allegations regarding specific teachers?
It does. So three specific teachers are named in the suit, and then five others are listed, although they're not named. They're either called, person A, person B, or they're listed by their initials.
In the district, it has had cases in recent years of sexual abuse and misconduct where action was taken. Is that right? What happened there?
That's right. So three of the named people out of those, two of them have already been arrested and charged. One person, her name is Bryn Larson. She pleaded no contest to third degree sexual assault of a student in 2021 and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. And another person, Gail Gander, he was charged for sex crimes involving a student in January. And both of those people have, they were immediately removed from their positions. The third person who's named in the lawsuit, it's unclear if that person is still teaching at the school. I asked about that. I've gotten kind of conflicting reports.
So what are the next steps for this federal complaint? What is being sought here?
So it was filed yesterday, and they're waiting for it to be assigned to a judge, and then it will move on. The attorney says that they want a jury trial and that the alleged victims would like to be compensated.
What has been the response from the Oconto Falls School District when you reached out?
You know, I reached out to the school board because the board is named. They did not respond. The superintendent did in a statement, Stuart Russ. He said that these plaintiffs have threatened the district and they made substantial monetary demands last year. He also said that the two people that I mentioned earlier, you know, have been charged and removed. And he said that if there are more instances, that it will be dealt with.
Corey, thank you for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That is Corinne Hess, WPR's K-12 reporter based in Milwaukee. And now to find out more on how to keep young people safe from predatory behavior and how the current system is working, we turn to Ian Henderson, Policy and Systems Director at the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the nature of schools and other places where young people gather, it often involves adults working alongside children. Is the system as it exists today able to fully prevent predatory behavior?
Well, I think the reporting you all just talked about and the story from yesterday, as well as going back to some of the media going back last fall, the Capital Times did an article about educator sexual misconduct, right, seems to indicate or be an example of system failure with respect to sexual violence and systems failing survivors. And, you know, there are plenty, sadly, there are plenty of other examples, whether it's campus sexual abuse within sports or the military, right? This seems to be yet another example of systems failing survivors.
When sexual misconduct or abuse happens, you know, knowing who to report it to and being able to rely on a response certainly is very important. What does that look like when this is working well and there's a culture of safety?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we heard about that just in the previous conversation, right, about adults, right? When we're talking about child sexual abuse prevention, right, ultimately we want the responsibility on intervening to fall on adults. We don't want that to fall on kids, right? And so we want adults to intervene and to stop the abuse and to intervene and to respond to the survivor. But I think that's particularly true with adults who are in positions of responsibility or authority, right? Just looking at the reporting regarding educator sexual misconduct and what we've learned over the past 6 months or so seems to be cases where, right, nothing was done. And really that's not an option, right? We need to have ultimately child sexual abuse prevention adults who know and are aware of something intervening and doing something to stop the abuse.
Ian, the federal lawsuit against Oconto Falls School District, it alleges there was a climate that allowed for repeated abuse to happen over and over spanning years. How difficult is it to root out a culture of abuse and create a healthy environment where young people can thrive and be safe?
Right. I think that's a really good question. I think it speaks to the need for investing in comprehensive sexual violence prevention efforts. Right. I think, you know, there are, you know, we heard about some of the new laws that have been signed, you know, and those things can help. But right, we're not going to be able to legislate our way out of this problem. Right. We need ultimately to look at, you know, what are the social norms that exist in our culture that allow this to happen. And so I think, you know, educating people about the dynamics of sexual abuse, particularly sexual abuse involving kids, looking at the power disparity between educators and youth, right? I think that's what has to happen is an investment. Ultimately, we don't want any more survivors, right? We don't want this to happen to anyone else. And so I think that's going to take looking at and examining the social norms that exist that support and allow sexual violence to perpetuate.
You say we can't legislate our way out of this, but this month we have two new laws. Governor Evers signed a new law that makes grooming a felony. The other regarding communication between employees and students. How effective do you expect these new laws to be at prevention?
Well, I think, you know, I think they can help, absolutely, right? And I think we supported both of those bills. They can fill in gaps, particularly with respect to grooming, right? That some of the behaviors regarding grooming fall short of what we say contact sexual violence, right? That might fall under our existing criminal statutes, right? But I think it's also important to acknowledge we've had, back to some of the cases that you all have uncovered and talked about with respect to the lawsuit, or even going back to the reporting last fall, right? We've had mandatory reporting laws, or we have them. We've had existing child sexual assault laws, right? And so I think we can't rely on the criminal legal system as our sole focus for addressing sexual violence, right? A, it only offers one type of accountability. It offers punishment. And for some survivors, that may be what they want, but for others, they may not want that. They don't want this to happen to someone else. And we're talking about educators, right? Ultimately, that might mean maybe that person doesn't get to work with kids anymore, right? Maybe they lose their job, right? And I don't, there are different standards with respect to the criminal legal system as there are for employment. But ultimately, I think about the access that educators have to kids or anyone who has access to kids, right? I don't want to just hyper-focus on educators, although that's obviously what we're talking about here, right? I think it's fair to say we should expect a higher standard on who is engaging and interacting with our kids on a day-to-day basis, right? And having a higher standard for that. So yes, the new laws can help, but we can't just rely on the criminal legal system as a sole solution for addressing the problem of sexual violence.
And predatory behavior toward children, it has been a topic that has come up in political circles, in the media. Why are these conversations happening now?
Well, I think it is not uncommon when there is media attention on sexual violence, which obviously, you know, as someone who works in the anti-sexual violence field, shining a light on the fact that that is a problem, we appreciate that, right? But it's also, I think, true that what we see happening often is when there's a lot of media attention on a particular issue related to sexual violence, in this case, if it's educator sexual misconduct, right? Mm-hmm. It has been in the news recently, not just yesterday, but going back to last fall, I think it's not uncommon for survivors to see and read that and to, you know, therefore come forward, right? That we see that happen not infrequently.
Realizing they're not alone. Ian,
absolutely.
Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me and appreciate you covering the story.
Ian Henderson, Policy and Systems Director at the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, 24-hour construction at a Port Washington data center has local residents protesting. We'll hear from the mayor and from people living near the project.
We call our neighborhood the land of the midnight sun now because hundreds of extremely bright work lights that they have shine in our windows 24 hours a day.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Protein is having its moment in the spotlight. Companies are adding more protein-enhanced products to their lineups. And new federal dietary guidelines put the nutrient front and center.
Harvest Public Media's Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval reports on whether or not Americans actually need more protein.
It's not hard to find protein-packed foods. For years, consumers have enjoyed protein shakes, powders, and bars. But lately, it's been showing up in some surprising places.
Hello, welcome to Starbucks. What can I get started here today?
I'll do a vanilla protein latte.
Ooh, okay, so that protein, period. Okay, do you want a hotter ice today?
The company is just one of many that have introduced new lines of protein-enhanced products to meet increasing demand. A survey last year from the International Food Information Council found that 7 in 10 Americans want to include protein in their diets.
It's been picking up momentum in videos and TikTok.
Corey Geiger is a dairy economist for CoBank, a national lender. Geiger has studied the newfound appetite for protein. He says it's more than just a social media trend. It's now aligned with a political agenda.
Certainly, more recently, the MAHA movement has amplified what has been taking place in Americana.
The federal government unveiled new dietary guidelines in January that put protein front and center in the American diet. Officials say the new recommendations will, quote, make America healthy again. At a press conference announcing the changes, Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Marty McCary urged Americans to eat more protein.
The old guidelines had such a low protein recommendation, that we are increasing that by 50 to 100%.
It's a change that dietitians across the country have mixed feelings about. Stanford University nutrition professor Christopher Gartner served on the board that made recommendations to the government. He says the administration largely ignored them. And he calls prioritizing protein bizarre.
Americans have been a little short on calcium, potassium, fiber, and vitamin D. Protein was not and has never been in that list of things that we're short of.
He points out that Americans are among the highest per capita consumers of protein-rich meat in the world. Cleveland Clinic dietitian Julia Zumpano says Americans are getting enough protein, mostly because they're consuming more calories than they need. Instead, she'd like Americans to be more mindful of where they get their protein.
Occasional red meats, an abundance of fish, poultry, a regular intake of legumes and beans. You know, eggs are infiltrated in there. The main source of dairy protein is in the form of yogurt.
Some nutrition experts think we do need more protein, like Stuart Phillips, a kinesiology professor at McMaster University in Canada. He agrees with the federal guidelines for protein intake. But Phillips thinks the new food pyramid overemphasizes the role protein should play in people's diets.
It's just that putting them on the top means that they should be eaten the most and more often. That's the sort of implication of the way the pyramid is based now. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
And he worries the new emphasis could encourage people to consume protein-enhanced products they don't need, especially if they don't exercise. Products, perhaps, like the latte I bought and am now about to enjoy. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including WPR.
Data center construction is happening in many communities around Wisconsin, and many of those projects have seen local pushback. That's been the case in Port Washington near Lake Michigan.
Residents of Port Washington say they're becoming increasingly frustrated by the lights, noises, and dust being produced by construction on the Vantage Data Center's Lighthouse campus.
Construction was originally limited to a 12 to 14 hour period each day, but for months the city has allowed round-the-clock construction on weekdays.
Last week, residents presented a letter to both the city's Common Council and the Port Washington Town Board requesting that the city go back to enforcing the old hours by March 15th. It was signed by 100 people, according to the Ozaukee Press.
In just a bit, we'll hear from the citizens who wrote and signed that letter.
First, earlier this week, I talked about the issue with Ted Knightsky, mayor of the city of Port Washington. What led to the community having this 24-hour construction permitted on this data center?
So there was a request from the contractors and Vantage Corporation to be able to work 24 hours for a limited period of time through spring in order to catch up on their project map. As the project had begun in winter, the original project map had had them starting in September, and they had requested the ability to move to 24 hours of work during that time period, specifically around earthwork and pad preparation, so they could catch up on their calendar. And their request was granted by the Planning Commission because the city of Port Washington would like this project to close as fast as possible, because that's not only part of our developer's agreement, but positions the city to begin to increase the value and tax that property. So any length of time extended on the project would be to the detriment of our local community and taxpayers.
And we've got this letter from a bunch of people in the community saying, hey, we're worried about the noise, the traffic, and especially, I think, that 24-hour issue, the, hey, this is going on overnight. What, as you look at those community concerns, what is your response?
So I have great empathy. I very much understand it. I've gone out there many times myself in the evening. It's Monday through Friday, not on the weekends. And as people have come to our council meetings and brought to our attention different issues, we have immediately put pressure on the contractors to fix that. We've heard about jake braking on dump trucks, and we've learned that those contractors who were doing that were terminated. People making lots of noise as they were coming and going. You know, as different things have been brought to the attention of the contractor group, we've asked them to address it as quickly as possible. And we are currently reviewing whether or not we're going to allow that 24 hours through the end of May, which was their request. And we're working with the company to determine what are the consequences of us cutting off that 24 hours a day.
So what are the factors you're weighing as you and your fellow decision makers decide, hey, maybe we should end this 24-hour weekday window sooner than planned?
Well, the first thing we want to do is we want to be good neighbors. I mean, I grew up in town. A lot of those friends, a lot of the people who signed that and are frustrated are people I grew up with and I'm friends with. And we've asked them, you know, just please keep telling us, you know, what you need, what they are. You know, for instance, one of the things that had occurred was our school bus depot is out in the area adjacent to the construction. And the bus depot traffic on the county highway was becoming so great that the buses were leaving late and not able to get the kids picked up on time. So we immediately worked with Vantage Corporation, and the next day they had flagmen out there and they were stopping traffic and the buses were leaving on time. So as concerns have been brought directly to us, we've been able to respond to it. Many of the complaints are brought up on social media where we're not monitoring those chat groups or those conversations, but when they're brought to us, we act upon them. So really what we're trying to do here now is determine how can the Vantage Corporation work to reduce the 24-hour need, shift the impact of noise and sound in the evening so that the majority of that work is done during the day, and really position the citizens of the city of Port Washington as well as the town of Port Washington to, you know, not have their evenings interrupted by this mass construction project.
I suppose somebody might say, hey, hang on, if we end that 24-hour window sooner and it bumps back construction, I don't know, a couple few months, is that big a financial impact for the city not getting that tax revenue going for maybe an extra 2 or 3 months?
It certainly would be. I mean, we would prefer that all of these projects are wrapped up within the timeline that was established. And if that construction project takes us into another year, that shifts a lot of the valuation. And really, that's a small part of the weight. Really, what we want to do is be good neighbors and ensure that, you know, we can work with both. We, at the end of the day, when we had the groundbreaking for Vantage, my expectation was that they respected the land. And now that they've discovered us, they follow the rules of hiking. Leave us better than you found us. And right now we're in a pinch point as a result of that 24-hour construction. And the city's advocating to find ways to reduce that impact on everyone.
Now, long term, it's no secret to you, I'm sure, there have been a lot of pro and con arguments about the value of bringing data centers into communities. What is your hope when this thing is up and running? What do you hope that this accomplishes for Port Washington?
I hope what we see in Port Washington is what I saw when I visited data centers in Loudoun County, Virginia, which was very large technology warehouses with, you know, hundreds of employees that quietly operated in the community and created significant tax base that elevated the entire region. And that's what I saw when I went and visited them, and that's what's already started to happen. We have thousands of workers keeping our downtown restaurants, hotels, and businesses busy. We've got our whole community's elevating. And for me personally, number one is what it's gonna do for future workforces and our education system and our public schools, because we don't have a major employer in our region. Last year, you know, when new businesses open in Port Washington, they have maybe 4 or 5 employees. And that's not something, you know, that our young men, women, and people will go off to college or tech school or military or the workforce. There's nothing to look forward to in a major way in our region. And now there is. And that's what I'm hoping.
Mayor Nightsky, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's Ted Nightsky, mayor of Port Washington. Now we'll meet two local residents who are raising concerns about the 24-hour construction at this data center site. Kirk Dayheck is a resident of Port Washington who recently authored a letter to both the city's Common Council and the Port Washington Town Board. And Kim Tydrick is one of the 100 affected people who signed that letter. Kirk, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Kim, thanks for being with us.
Anytime.
Now, Kim, you live close to this construction site. Can you give us a sense of what it's like living near this 24-hour weekday construction?
I don't think I can portray it very well over the radio. However, I will say that we call our neighborhood the land of the midnight sun now because the hundreds of extremely bright work lights that they have shine in our windows 24 hours a day. We have incessant backup beeping, which we were assured we would never hear by the mayor of Port Washington. And a lot of people are having really bad experiences with dirt carrying into their homes. We all have it on our cars and such as that, but some people are really having bad experiences. Everyone's experience is a little bit different based on where they are and where the construction is happening day to day, but no one should have to live through this.
Kirk, you've been in touch with a lot of people, I think, in the community. What experiences are you hearing of Kim's and others? How many people are affected? What kind of stories are you hearing from people?
Kim's remarks are spot on. That is the general consensus. And I wasn't originally invested in this. I am more of a, let's wait and see. It got to a point where Vantage no longer complied with the guidance provided them in the development agreement that said 24-hour-a-day construction was okay, but not on Saturday nights into Sundays. And 4 a.m. on a Saturday morning, when I called the Ozaukee County Sheriff's Department, that was my last straw. And with the encouragement of others, I was invited to, well, let's just go see what the temperature in the neighborhood is. I was more surprised by the thanks I got from everybody I stopped and talked to as being somebody that was interested in doing anything to get any sort of resolution, mitigation out of any leadership in the city or the town of Port Washington.
Kirk, you recently authored a letter to the Port Washington Common Council and the Town Council as well, signed, I understand, by a bunch of residents in the area. What were you requesting?
I was simply requesting ending 24-hour-a-day construction. Somewhat dissatisfied, 24-hour-a-day construction started with a planning commission agenda in November of 25 that did not mention that. 24-hour-a-day construction was requested at that meeting solely by Vantage, moved and approved by the mayor with nobody at the meeting because it wasn't on the agenda. Kim showed up at a subsequent planning commission meeting and was chastised by the mayor and subsequently had her mic turned off because it wasn't on the agenda for that planning commission meeting before the city council. I have issues with that. The mayor can publicly, outward facing, say, we've been plenty transparent. You can look at the agenda, you can look at the decisions, and that's patently false.
Kim, the mayor and others have said, hey, we need this, the company needs this 24-hour schedule to get this thing done on schedule. It's going to start bringing in tax revenue faster, right, than if they slowed things down. There's going to be benefits to the local economy, local schools, and things like that. Do you see the possibility that, hey, there some good could come out of this rushing it and suffering through this 24-hour-a-day deal?
Honestly, as a town resident, we get no benefits whatsoever. The city supposedly will get some tax benefits. That's questionable. There are different ways, apparently, of looking at it and calculating it. But as town residents, we get nothing.
And Kirk, that's part of the complication here. There's a city, there's a town involved, there's annexation of parts of the town by the city. Does that make it complicated for you and fellow residents to tackle your concerns here?
Absolutely. Part of the problem is, as a town resident, my recourse is my elected officials. My elected officials told a line that in the recently executed border agreement with the city, they assigned any ability to oppose anything the data center wants to do, that they have no responsibility to that. We go to city council meetings, and any remarks we present at a city council meeting are noted in the minutes as non-resident comments regarding opposition to data center. That's the end. When the city council and the town board control the narrative, they have the ability to simply bury any adverse interpretation of any conduct they do. It wasn't until I actually attended a town board meeting that I found out that I had been labeled as a data center agitator, which you can say I'm agitating, but it's principally because I'm agitated, because it's been 3 to 4 months of virtually no sleep and no resolution and no acknowledgement from either of town governance or city governance that, hey, we're just going to ask you to bear with us a bit longer. I've bared with you long enough.
And we'll leave it there. Kirk, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Kim, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Kirk Dahak is a resident of Port Washington. He recently wrote a letter to both the city's Common Council and the Port Washington Town Board protesting 24-hour construction on the nearby data center project. And Kim Tydrick is one of the 100 affected people who signed that letter. Earlier, we heard from Mayor of Port Washington, Ted Neitzke, about how the city is responding to resident concerns. In answer to claims about open public access to public meetings, Mayor Neitzke told Wisconsin Today that Plan Commission meetings have to be relevant to the meeting's agenda and that comments at a February 19th meeting didn't meet that standard. And in a statement, the company Vantage acknowledged the late-night weekend work, quote, "We sincerely apologize to our Port Washington neighbors for overnight work performed during a weekend in February," end quote. They say they will avoid those hours in the future.
Coming up, Wisconsin is home to historic grottos. A new museum exhibit and a new album highlight the unique artistic tradition.
They sort of continue to resonate today because they were really designed to attract people and bring people to them in sort of acts of pilgrimage.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Driving around Wisconsin, you might find unexpected little pieces of architecture, grottos.
Grottos are small cave-like structures, often made with concrete and decorated with everyday items like marbles and seashells.
German Catholics brought the tradition with them to Wisconsin in the early 1900s. At the time, they were often used as shrines.
Now, artists are putting their own spin on grottos. Later, we'll meet two Eau Claire musicians who created a new album inspired by a grotto in Milwaukee.
First, an exhibit at the Kohler Arts Center highlights this unique piece of Wisconsin culture. Laura Bickford is associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Arts Center in Sheboygan, where she oversees exhibits, including A Beautiful Experience, the Midwest Grotto Tradition, on display through May 10th. Laura, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For people who haven't seen some of Wisconsin's grottos, can you paint us a picture? What are they? What do they look like?
Yeah, most of them are really impressive, I have to say. Usually made of concrete and then pretty heavily adorned with a variety of objects. Typically in Wisconsin, they're more man-made objects, glass, broken dishware, tchotchkes. In the case of the Dickeyville Grotto, there's hundreds of gear shift knobs that was donated by the Ford company. And when you get out into Iowa, some of them are more heavily adorned with gemstones and natural minerals. They often have various shrines encompassing in them dedicated to different religious figures and sort of various sites for people to have reflective prayer. Super, super maximalist, really abundant, brightly colored, heavily, heavily adorned.
Why did Wisconsin and some of Iowa become such a rich site for grotto builders?
I think there's a few reasons, really having to do with the history of immigration in the region, specifically German Catholics. And so the grotto tradition actually dates back to paganism in Europe, where kind of sites of natural beauty and isolation, like caves, or sort of other inlets, became places of prayer. And people started bringing sort of offerings there to sort of help in their prayer and devotion. Eventually, as a lot of things happened with the spread of Catholicism, these pagan places of worship were turned into Catholic traditional places of worship. And when German Catholics came over to Wisconsin, a few priests brought that tradition with them. And sort of in a joint effort to spread Catholicism and promote patriotism and form communities, they started adapting the form, not in caves, but kind of creating man-made alcoves to sort of create these grotto sites for community and prayer and reflection.
Laura, I think of grottos as being in the place they were built. That's got to be a challenge to do at the Art Center, an exhibit featuring grottos. How do you recreate that, you know, in that place grotto experience in your exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main focuses of the exhibition is a grotto that was made by a woman named Madeline Buell. And she was living in Dubuque, Iowa, really heavily inspired by the Dickeyville Grotto, which was just right over the river from her. And the Art Center actually worked to remove that grotto from her yard in the mid-2000s, 2011, after the family sort of had sold the house. And so that kind of monumental 13-piece grotto is in the collection of the Art Center. And although mobile, it's definitely not sort of easily moved. And so it had never been shown before the occasion of this exhibition. And though that really forms the center of this project, and my co-curator and I then sort of populated the exhibition with other elements that could help tell the story, other objects inspired, made by artists that were also inspired by grottos kind of throughout the last century, including contemporary work made just for the show. We also included a lot of sort of components of Madeline Buell's grotto that speak to the construction of grottos and the sort of intuition and intentionality that couples them. And we also included a lot of ephemera and tourist material, particularly about the Dickeyville Grotto, which sort of speaks to how these grottos became so well known and visited in Wisconsin and why they sort of continue to resonate today, because they were really designed to attract people and bring people to them in sort of acts of pilgrimage.
And talk a little bit about the Dickeyville Grotto. I think the fair to say the most famous grotto in Wisconsin, far southwestern Wisconsin. What is the significance of that site?
Yeah, totally. It is definitely the most famous sort of in Wisconsin and became a pivotal experience for a lot of other artists throughout the state, many of which are in our collection. And the Dickeyville Grotto was built by Father Matthias Wernerus, who attended seminary in Milwaukee and then was assigned to the Holy Ghost Parish in Dickeyville, Wisconsin, and almost immediately started making this grotto. And from the very beginning, it was a tourist destination. We have an article from the dedication of the grotto where hundreds of thousands of people came to Dickeyville. There were celebrities, there was politicians sort of dedicating the grotto. And early on, as I said, that was important because the Catholic Church had sort of said, yeah, you can do this grotto as long as it's not taking away from any of your other duties. And so advertising it as a tourist attraction was a way for the father to continue to fundraise to be able to support the construction of the grotto and not take away from the church. So early on, you know, there were buttons and maps, there were signs all over the highway, you can still see them. And it was really designed to bring people there, which also became important for the German Catholic community as a way of spreading their patriotism, kind of letting people know that they were Americans and proud to be Americans. Part of the Dickeyville Grotto is a shrine to Christopher Columbus. And it's sort of equally rooted in the tenets of patriotism and religion or spirituality. So they wanted to say that despite being German and holding their Catholic sermons in German, they were proud Americans and wanted to create a space where people could connect and they could, you know, sort of share their beliefs and their pride with the rest of the Dickeyville community.
We're talking to Laura Bickford, Associate Curator at the John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, talking about grottos and the museum's current exhibit, A Beautiful Experience, the Midwest Grotto Tradition. Now we'll bring into the conversation two Eau Claire musicians, percussionist Joe Westerland and trumpet player Trevor Hagen. The two recently teamed up for an album called Grotto. Joe and Trevor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Joe, if I made a list of albums inspired by grottos, I think it'd be a pretty short list. What inspired the two of you to team up and make this album inspired by the grotto tradition?
Well, in 2025, spring of 2025, I was invited by the Kohler Arts Center to come to the Mary Knoll Grotto and do a video project in which I composed a piece in basically in the moment that I was first experiencing her house. And that went really well, and we had a great time, and I was invited back in the winter of 2025 to do another project in the art preserve. And I just immediately thought of my friend Trevor that we had just started playing together on some of my stuff. And it felt time to turn that collaboration into a duo. So I mentioned it to them and they thought it was a great idea. And the two of us, we booked a 5-date tour throughout Wisconsin, kind of around this anchor date at the Kohler, and recorded at Trevor's family cabin at the end of that.
And Trevor, tell us about your experience visiting the Mary Knoll Grotto in particular in Milwaukee for the first time as I guess part of research for this album.
Absolutely. It was a very surprising visit because I didn't know what kind of I was getting into. I wasn't familiar with Mary Knoll until Joe mentioned some of her work to me. And so when we arrived, I was really stunned by just this environment that she created for herself and how she's able to sustain herself in this very beautiful, striking house that was somewhat playful, so just very creative in its patterns and how elaborate it was designed by her for herself. So I think seeing the Knoll House was really seeing someone take their way of expressing themselves, their art, and making it for this one place. And I think that really stuck with us of the importance of place and creation and making art.
Laura, before we get into the music, I want to hear more about the Mary Knoll Grotto that inspired this album and its significance in the Wisconsin art world.
Yeah, so Mary Knoll's home is right on the shore of Lake Michigan. It was her family's summer cottage that after she moved in, she completely transformed. Almost every surface of the interior and exterior was touched by her, in addition to having over 30 concrete sculptures on the property. And as Joe and Trevor said, it's a sort of total personal meditation on the property, on the lake, on her life. She really was omnivorous, using sort of every available material to try out ideas and experiment. The Art Center stewards the site, and it's just one of several examples of adorned concrete artistic environments that populate the state of Wisconsin. Mary Knoll's is particularly important and impactful because it's a rare extant example that was made by a woman, and it's almost completely intact, which is also incredibly rare and makes it sort of exceedingly special.
All right, now let's go into how we turn that visual thing into this album, this audio incarnation. Joe, let's start with you there. As I listen to the album, I'm hearing it's almost like I'd call them almost soundscapes before I'd say songs in some ways. How did you start translating this weird artistic environment into music?
Yeah, it wasn't so much that we were translating exactly Mary Knoll's environment into our own environment, but more taking inspiration from witnessing hers and knowing that, you know, Trevor and I come from a long background together of like being friends since we were seven, being in bands together, us splitting apart for a while he was living overseas for over a decade, and just doing our various things, having our own experiences with exploring music in sort of unconventional ways. Basically, we kind of came to the conclusion that this kind of sound world that happens when the two of us come together sort of forms a house. These like different soundscapes, as you say, or you know, some melodies in there, they all kind of added to, they were the decorations, they were the decorative quality of this home that we were building together.
And Trevor, playing the melodic instrument here, the trumpet on many parts of these tracks, how did you take that inspiration from the Mary Knoll House and put it to music?
I think partly what's really wonderful playing music with Joe, and as Joe's mentioned, we have a long background together, is, you know, we're really honest with each other and honest with our playing, and I think very sincere about it when we play together. And I think that was the feeling we got from Mary's work as well, and for how she put these, you know, how she decorated her house and how she engaged with even the art world or other entities outside of her art environment. I think, so her approach to all of this, to really being, not for herself, but like doing things that were aesthetically pleasing to her. I think that's really influenced a lot of how Joe and I have also come to our own sounds, our own approaches. So yeah, the style, she's really been hugely influential in our playing and how we are approaching playing.
Laura, you say you've seen exhibit visitors be inspired by the grottos. What are you hearing and seeing as people come through and learn more about this Wisconsin tradition?
I think a lot of people are surprised that they actually knew about it before the exhibition, or they had some familiarity. A lot of people have some memories of going either to Dickeyville or seeing some sort of adorned concrete creation or Virgin Mary bathtub shrine on the side of the road. And once they're sort of reminded of this vernacular tradition, they can place it in a bunch of other experiences. And I think kind of what Trevor and Joe were talking about this kind of highly specific, but somehow then universal sense of wonder and awe that we often feel in these religious spaces really comes across, but they feel incredibly familiar and approachable. And something about them really speaks to the Midwestern, upper Midwestern landscape that I think people are drawn to. And I've heard so many visitors talk about wanting to go home and make their own grotto, finally finding a place for all of their broken dishes, but really feeling a sense of connectedness to the expression and the place that I haven't experienced in a lot of other exhibitions.
So Trevor, I guess the ultimate full circle would be, have you had a chance to take your album and go to the Mary Knoll Grotto and listen to it? And if not, is that something you'd want to do to just have the full experience?
Absolutely. No, we haven't had the chance to do that yet, but we did. We were playing Milwaukee about a month ago, and we got to go return to the Mary Knoll House and really see it with new eyes. And when we were there, I heard from my uncle that my mother and he used to go and visit the Mary Knoll House, or rather bikes by it. So I also had a nice connection to my family being there a long time ago as well. So that's a new story for me.
And how about you, Joe, the opportunity to experience that music there? Is that something you'd like, maybe a live show or some kind of event at the grotto where it all started?
Oh, absolutely. That'd be epic. We would very much welcome that opportunity.
All right, we'll leave it there. Joe, Trevor, Laura, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Laura Bickford, Associate Curator at the Kohler Arts Center in Sheboygan, and Joe Westerland and Trevor Hagen, two Eau Claire musicians who are out with a new instrumental album called Grotto. The exhibit called A Beautiful Experience, the Midwest Grotto Tradition, is on display at the Kohler Arts Center in Sheboygan through May 10th. As we've been hearing, the Midwest is known for its large collection of grottos, mostly built by German Catholic immigrant priests and artists.
And these regional grottos draw visitors to ornate places for prayer, reflection, and creativity.
And we want to know, have you visited a grotto? Maybe you've been to the Grotto of the Redemption in West Bend, Iowa, the largest man-made grotto in the world. Or you've been to the Dickeyville Grotto in Wisconsin. What do you remember from those shrines?
Years ago, I visited the grotto in Portland, Oregon. It is stunning. It is a peaceful sanctuary carved into the cliffs.
Share your experiences, your memories of grottos. Email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org, or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Beatrice Lawrence, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Brad Kohlberg.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.